This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Wednesday, March 1st, 2006. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Shiro Kanyugo, sitting in for Auda Bogado. President Bush makes a historic trip to India, seeking greater global cooperation. And we'll hear from Capitol Hill on the debate over Bush's proposals to cut education funding. These stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Kosovo's prime minister resigned today, 1 week after the first round of talks were completed in Vienna to determine the political and legal status of the United Nations-administered province. It has been nearly 7 years since the end of civil fighting between independence-minded Albanian guerrillas and Serbian security forces in the former Yugoslavia. Jackson Allers reports from Kosovo's capital, Pristina.
Prime Minister Bajram Kosumi handed his resignation to Kosovo President Fatmir Sedju this afternoon amidst criticism from Western countries like the United States, who said he did not do enough to meet democratic standards set by the United Nations in the lead-up to the current negotiations on Kosovo's final status. Kosumi succeeded former Prime Minister Ramush Haradinaj, who was indicted on war crimes charges by the UN Tribunal at The Hague 1 year ago. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan criticized Kosumi in January for not doing more to integrate the more than 100,000 Serbs who remained in Kosovo after the end of fighting in 1999. Kosovo Serbs and other minorities have faced a growing litany of hardships as Kosovo's economy is sputtering and the unemployment rate is said to be at about 50%. The former senior commander of the Kosovo Liberation Army, Agim Čeku, is said to be the top candidate for replacing Kosumi. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, this is Jackson Allers in Pristina, Kosovo.
The ongoing cycle of violence in the Palestinian-occupied territories has claimed two lives today. Manar Jibrin has the latest.
Abu Walid al-Dahduh, a top leader of the armed wing of the Islamic Jihad in Gaza, was killed today when his car exploded. Witnesses say an Israeli warjet fired a missile at his vehicle, but Israel denies involvement. In the West Bank, an Israeli settler is dead after he was shot in the head at the gas station where he worked. Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade claimed responsibility. Early this morning, a large Israeli force of at least 6 military vehicles invaded the West Bank village of Beit Fajar near Bethlehem and declared the village a closed military zone. The soldiers conducted a house-to-house search and arrested 12 Palestinian youth. The Israeli army has been carrying out arrest campaigns among Palestinian civilians, claiming that the arrestees are wanted members of armed resistance groups. Many of these arrest attempts end with assassinations. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Palestine, this is Manar Jibrin.
Unrest in an Afghan prison ended today with the transfer of some 1,300 prisoners to a different area of the same prison. 6 inmates are dead after a 4-day riot that began when prison authorities attempted to mandate the use of uniforms. Prisoners were demanding better living conditions and calling for a review of their convictions. The prison, located outside of Kabul, gained infamy as a torture center during the era of communist rule in the 1980s. George W. Bush began his tour of South Asia today with a surprise visit to Afghanistan. This as Canada plans to increase its presence in the occupied country, even though polls show that the majority of Canadians are against sending troops. Qasem Tirmizi reports from Montreal.
2,200 new Canadian troops arrived in Kandahar in February, and a Canadian general took command of the multinational coalition in southern Afghanistan yesterday. This increased participation in the occupation of the war-torn country comes as a new opinion poll shows that 62% of Canadians are opposed to sending troops to Afghanistan, and 73% of Canadians would like a parliamentary vote on whether the mission should be renewed. Defense Minister Gordon O'Connor has rejected such measures as unnecessary. The recently deployed troops will be in Afghanistan for up to 1 year. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Montreal, I'm Qasem Tirmizi.
As we go to air, Reuters is reporting that militants in the Niger Delta region have released 6 foreign oil workers. 3 workers, 2 Americans and a Briton, continue to be held hostage. To deal with the ongoing security situation in the Niger Delta region, Nigeria is turning to China to protect oil installations. Samuel Okoya reports from Lagos.
Nigeria's Vice President Atiku Abubakar told the Financial Times of London that Nigeria has to source military equipment elsewhere because talks with the U.S. over security plans for the Niger Delta region did not appear to be moving as fast as the situation is unfolding. The patrol boats the U.S. supplied to Nigeria for use in the Niger Delta have proved inadequate. Armed attacks by militant youths in the last weeks have forced Nigeria to reduce oil exports by 20%. China, with its growing oil demand, has shown interest in the Niger Delta and is now stepping in as a key supplier of arms to protect oil installations in the region. Nigeria is the world's sixth largest oil exporter. The U.S. plans to increase its oil imports from Nigeria. China's military involvement in the region may clash with America's interest. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
Subway workers in Seoul today began the largest rail strike in Korean history. Dante Tosa reports.
After a breakdown in negotiations with the administrators of the public rail system, 16,000 subway workers walked off the job at 1 o'clock this morning. The South Korean government declared the strike illegal and has threatened to prosecute the workers who participate. The unions are demanding better working conditions, pay raises, a halt in employing temporary workers with no job security or benefits, and the rehiring of 67 workers who were fired for organizing a so-called illegal strike last year. The trains are currently operating at 16%. The workers say the strike will go on indefinitely or until the demands are met. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Dante Toza reporting from Seoul.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Education Secretary Margaret Spelling says she backs the education budget proposed by the president. The budget seeks to cut education funding by more than $3 billion and targets low-income education programs for defunding. Those opposed to the drastic cuts to education are calling it scandalous. Leanne Caldwell reports from Capitol Hill.
Of the $3 billion in proposed cuts to discretionary education spending, $2.1 could be cut to Equality in Education Initiatives, also known as Title I. That means that 40 programs would be eliminated, including grants to low-income high school students. Vocational education programs would be greatly reduced, and Pell Grant funding for low-income college students would remain stagnant, a proposal that does not sit well with some on Capitol Hill.
Education is simply underfunded. And when I took a look at the president's budget, we're always asked for comment, and I wanted to be definitive and brief and chose the word scandalous, which I think it is. It's simply insufficient to have continual cuts on discretionary programs. We're regrettably moving to a system where there be no discretionary funding at all.
Several senators echoed those remarks by Republican Senator Arlen Specter. They said this budget will add more schools to the 11,000 already on the poor performance list. These are the largest budget cuts to Title I programs in 18 years. Democratic Senator Tom Harkin from Iowa pressed Department of Education Secretary Margaret Spellings on her opinion of the budget.
I'm just asking you, do you back it? Do you back it as you sent it?
Certainly.
Does your boss, the president, back it as it was sent up?
Yes, he does.
So he wants it enacted just like that?
Well, I think he believes that this is the smartest, best allocation of resources given all the various priorities.
I just want to get that clear for the record.
At today's appropriation hearing in the Senate, Secretary Spelling said that in a time of war, this is a strong education budget. The defense budget this year is proposed at $460 billion, not including war supplementals that will push it past half a trillion. The education budget is proposed at less than $55 billion. Secretary Spellings touted the High School Block Grants Initiative to increase high school performance. It would provide $1.5 billion for the nation's high schools to implement programs they deemed necessary.
We're saying get results and that we shouldn't sit up here and say, here's how you should get results.
That would also allow schools to reinstate programs that are no longer being funded by the federal government. But it's just not a policy shift. It's still a cut to funding. Again, Senator Harkin.
Yeah, I understand the high school initiative program, $1.475 billion, but there are 40-some programs that were eliminated. All the TRIO programs, Talent Search, Upward Bound, Math Science, Smaller Learning, all these. That's $2.1 billion. So you've taken away $2.1 billion that goes out to these high schools and say, no, now here's $1.5 billion.
Furthermore, No Child Left Behind would receive no additional funding. Secretary Spelling says that the new initiatives to increase competitiveness in math and science will implement new programs which will help students excel. She spoke of one.
For a new program called Math Now that will help elementary and middle school students develop the academic foundation to eventually take higher level math classes in high school, such as advanced placement courses.
The president's overall budget will say, I think he's saying it's something like $4.9 billion for this competitiveness initiative. Most of it is tax renewal of the research tax credits to benefit different industries.
Ed Keeley is director of the Committee for Educational Funding, which heads a coalition of 100 education advocate programs.
There's very little investment in education at all.
The president's education budget provides $380 million for math and science initiatives. With 45 million public school children, that comes to about $8 per child. A report released today by the American College Testing Program revealed that only half of tested high school graduates possessed the reading skills they need in college. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The National Congress of American Indians concludes its annual Tribal Nations Legislative Summit today. For 3 days, Native American tribal leaders across the United States gathered in Washington, D.C., seeking solutions to Indian country's challenges, including poor health care conditions and rampant methamphetamine abuse. Yan Meiji has the story.
President of the National Congress of Native Americans Joe Garcia says the most pressing issue confronting Native Americans is the low quality of health care services offered to them. Native Americans have a life expectancy 5 years less than the rest of the nation's population, and too many receive their health care in the emergency room when it is often too late. Garcia says he was shocked to learn that the U.S. government spends twice as much on federal prisoners' health care as for Native Americans. He asks tribal leaders to urge the Congress to reauthorize the Indian Health Care Improvement Act, a promise by the U.S. government to provide health care services to Native peoples. In his fiscal year 2007 budget plan, President Bush proposes to cut funding entirely from the Urban Indian Health Program, a project that offers assistance to urban Indians who face extraordinary barriers to access health care. Although the proposal requests a 4% funding increase to Indian health services, Indian health advocates say such a modest increase could not keep up with inflation and population growth. After hearing indigenous leaders' concerns about the budget proposal, Vice Chairman of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee Byron Dorgan, Democrat of North Dakota, says he's equally frustrated with the White House Office of Budget Management.
You've got areas that ought to be making policy choices, and yet all of that has to run through the OMB, as
right.
It's called.
Right.
And then it comes out of the OMB, and you know it goes in as a plum and comes out a prune. And so that's the way the system works out here. I'm as frustrated as you are.
According to Joe Garcia, another priority in Native American communities is to curb rampant methamphetamine use and the illicit manufacturing of meth. Meth labs are becoming a major plague in Indian country, according to the National American Indian Housing Council. In some instances, Garcia says, the drug use impacts the young and most innocent.
You know, I heard a case back home. We had a discussion about a parent and about the newborn baby. And the newborn baby was diagnosed with cocaine addiction.
Garcia says Native nations and Indians living in U.S. urban centers need support from the White House and the Congress to fight meth abuse. But he encourages tribal leaders to seek solutions among their own people. Senator Sam Brownback, a Kansas Republican, spoke on the last day of the summit. He authored a resolution offering an official apology to Native Americans on behalf of the U.S. government.
It's like somebody coming to you and doing something wrong to you. You know, they lie to you or they steal something from you. And then they come back later and they say, well, let's just be friends and let's just move on forward. you're thinking to yourself, until he admits to me that he lied to me or he stole from me, I'm not going to trust this guy.
Sandy Chichoui from Oglala Sioux Tribe in South Dakota reminds Senator Brownback that an apology is merely the first step.
And I would appreciate it if, along with the apology, that your colleagues would educate themselves, keep in touch with our National Congress of American Indians here on the Hill, and help us achieve betterment for our communities. Consider us for homeland security. We're capable.
Indigenous leaders met with Congress members and staff this afternoon to discuss their legislative agenda. I'm Ye Meixie for Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C.
President Bush kicked off his first visit to India today. The three-day visit to the former socialist country that recently privatized its economy, moved closer diplomatically to the U.S., and changed its Cold War foreign policy of non-alignment is viewed as highly strategic. Bush's delegation includes a 170-member team, including politicians, an army think tank, and chief executives of multinational corporations. While Indo-US lobbyists are hailing the partnership, some are wondering about Bush's interest in the region. Vinod K. Jose has more from New Delhi.
President Bush is presiding over the closest ties in history between Washington and New Delhi, two capitals that for decades watch each other with suspicion as India aligned with the Soviet Union and pursued a nuclear weapons race with Pakistan. Anchored on principles of socialism and welfare state, the free India of Mahatma Gandhi and Jawaharlal Nehru kept a distance from the United States. But things have changed with greater global corporatization. N. Srinivasan is the Director General of the country's biggest business lobbying group, the Confederation of Indian Industry, or CII.
India is changing, as is the US. What was good enough yesterday is not good enough today. India is becoming a player which is acknowledged and is respected as the fastest growing free market democracy. So this is an opportunity for the oldest democracy in the world and the largest democracy in the world to connect with each other in business terms. That is the CII, Indian industry's expectation.
Yesterday, India's finance minister presented the country's annual budget. He increased the military spending to $20 billion for the next financial year, making India one of the top weapon purchasers in the world. By 2040, India will overtake China in population. All this make India the perfect choice for the US business interest to invest. Shyam Charan, India's foreign secretary, on heightened US business interest to invest.
If there is a greater focus on India in the United States, it is not because India is weak, but it is because India is strong. Because we are being recognized as a country which has an array of capabilities.
Bharat Karnad is a professor in National Security Studies at the Center for Policy Research.
Value-wise, we are in sync. Globalizing economies, you guys now depend on India as we depend on you a lot of things. So now there's mutual dependence is growing, which is a very good thing. Not just one way anymore, like the old ship-to-mouth policies of the 50s when India didn't produce enough food. And India is such a big major player now that any time it tilts towards one side or the other, you can really tilt the balance.
The United States still imports far more from India than it exports into the country. A joint partnership started last year would open new arenas for US business interest in India, not just in potential nuclear sales, but in a variety of high technology products, from jets to rocket launchers to radar systems. But not everybody is happy with this. A.B. Bardhan is the General Secretary of India's mainstream left party, Communist Party of India.
In fact, it's a dramatic presentation of how India is giving up its original non-aligned policy and tilting, and not only tilting now, but even submitting to the US pressure.
The nuclear deal, agreed in principle last July when Manmohan Singh visited Washington, ran into trouble when the US insisted that India open its fast breeder reactors to their observers. Kamal Mitra Chenoy is a professor in international relations and a member of the Coalition for Nuclear Disarmament and Peace.
Basically, this is a kind of strategic embrace between the U.S. and India, which is unequal. Because the U.S. on its part has not agreed to any moratorium on nuclear testing. The U.S. does not accept the kind of IAEA safeguards on its nuclear facilities that it wants India to accept. The U.S. itself has in the past been a proliferator of nuclear technology to Israel and South Africa, along with European countries. So I think there's a great deal of nuclear hypocrisy involved in all this.
Both the administrations are trying their best to solve what they call the differences. One shall wait and see if Bush could clinch the nuclear deal or not in the coming days. Also, how many agreements he signs with India. From New Delhi in India, this is Vinod K. Jose for FSRN.
In colonial times, France guaranteed the CFA franc used by many of its West and Central African colonies. Years later, the CFA franc remains the currency used by a dozen African countries, while the French franc, the currency to which it was pegged, has disappeared with the arrival of the euro. In 1960, most African states gained independence. Yet, unlike some of the other European colonizing powers, France is still present in its former colonies, exploiting old cultural ties for technical, economic, and financial gains. From Senegal, Jaga Sek has more.
The CFA franc is too weak compared to the euro or the dollar. It doesn't cover many African countries, so I think Africa should have its own currency and try to be free from European countries.
Many Senegalese, like this seller, believe the CFA franc is a very weak currency. 655 CFA francs make 1 euro. But it is the currency of 15 francophone countries in Africa, first pegged to the French franc in 1948 and later to the euro. The currency is guaranteed by France, making it stable vis-à-vis the euro and allows France control over any final decisions. Economically, it gives France an advantage over its former colonies, gaining the equivalent of 650 million for every 1 billion of export receipts. Samba Bitay, a Senegalese economist, says this is harmful.
La garantie de la France n'est pas un service gratuit.
France guaranteeing the CFA franc is not just a reward to former colonies because of their loyalty, their faithfulness, and their friendliness. It is very beneficial to France. All exports receipts are not immediately returned. There's always the equivalent of 65% of export receipts kept in France and considered as change reserves. And whatever the case, be it for a family or a state, blocking some 65% of one's own revenues for whatever reason, except a bank investment that will bring future interest, is harmful.
In the 15th
century, France settled in Senegal, developing a slave trade along the coast. During the Industrial Revolution, Europeans invaded Africa for raw materials, and for over 10 years after 1854, France colonized Senegal. To keep populations under control, France used a divide-and-rule policy, and people born in the four most urbanized cities of Saint Louis, Gore, Dakar, and Rifisk were considered French citizens, while all the others were seen as indigenous. France also obliged the Senegalese nationals to grow peanuts due to enormous profits in the world market. Philippe Tin, a Senegalese history professor, says France's new form of domination is cooperation.
In colonial times, France intended to exploit the country economically. So French administrators started developing peanut crops, and only France was benefiting from that agriculture. Today, the domination has changed forms. It is no longer colonization, but cooperation in the technical, economic, financial, and cultural fields.
Sur le plan économique et financier, sur le plan culturel, etc., etc.
To date, 26% of Senegal's economic exchange is made with France, and main exports go to EU states. However, the poor West African states hardly has significant economic growth, due partly to its dependence on France. Jean-Pierre Senghor is a Senegalese businessman. He says business should be developed with other countries.
Aujourd'hui, en gros, si on veut faire des affaires,
Today, if we want to improve business, we should continue to work with France. That's the diplomatic course. But we should try to diversify, to look in other directions if we want to increase capital gains.
Senegal's official language is French, and its a currency, CFA franc. African states have yet to develop political will to be culturally independent and have a common currency that is competitive on the monetary market. For FSIN in Senegal, I'm Jagasek.
Law enforcement agencies from three Mexican states are meeting with their counterparts in New Mexico this week in an effort to better coordinate their criminal investigations across borders. The collaborations include workshops and tours of New Mexico's forensic laboratories. FSRN's Leslie Clark has more from Albuquerque.
This is our triage room. This is where once we've collected evidence, we will package the evidence, make sure that
law enforcement officials took an extensive tour of the sprawling Metropolitan Forensic Science Center, viewing departments including the ballistics lab, fingerprint evaluation center, and the evidence storage facility. Understanding their respective technical and law enforcement procedures will enhance public safety in both countries, according to Luis David Ortiz of the Nuevo León, Mexico, District Attorney's Office.
Crime organizations operate in all the states, in different states in Mexico and in the United States. People involved in human trafficking operate on both sides of the border, and the information is important. But not only the information, which already there are some channels that we have, but also the practical technical assistance of day-to-day investigation of new techniques, of new ways of applying science to come up with the truth about a crime is very helpful.
And Ortiz says Nuevo León uses some of the same technology provided by the same manufacturers as New Mexico. So comparing best practices would allow for better coordination of evidence processing within and between the agencies. Chihuahua District Attorney Patricia Rodriguez Gonzalez says sharing information is key to solving border problems. U.S. and Mexican officials are also cooperating within their judicial systems to combat crime in the two countries. New Mexico Attorney General Patricia Madrid points to several occasions when Mexico has extradited American criminals to New Mexico for prosecution.
The most recent example of this collaboration was the capture of Carlos Luis Valero in September 2005. Mr. Valero had been on the run from New Mexico authorities for 9 years for the murder of Celina Maria Cedillo in Albuquerque. I am very grateful to my counterpart, Gonzalez, for her help in the arrest of this murderer.
Attorney General Madrid worked with the Rule of Law Project to facilitate this week's forum. Rafael Herrera, Rule of Law Advisor in Mexico City, says Mexico and the United States realize the two countries have organized crime rings in common.
We have to learn how to deal with those people who are interested in combating organized crime rings. And I think that the ambassador, Tony Garza, and also USAID has realized that the best way of doing that is developing strong and healthy relationships between the two countries.
Cooperation between the Mexican and U.S. governments is a more viable way to combat crime in both countries and keep the border between them safe, according to many attending the forum in Albuquerque this week, rather than constructing walls between them. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leslie Clark in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Shiro Kanyugo, sitting in for Ada Bogado.